Chapter 7. Burma Raja and the Devas. Kalimpong was a small place. The news that the YMBA had been shut down and that the English monk who had done so much for the youth of the town was in danger of being thrown out for his pains spread rapidly. Most people's reaction was one of surprise, bewilderment, and in some cases indignation. For several months prior to my arrival on the scene, the Dharmodya Vihara had been practically deserted. Now, those very activities, which had at last made the place useful to the public, had been suddenly and savagely curtailed, indeed abolished altogether, and the Vihara was apparently being allowed to revert to its previous desolate and neglected condition. Among those most disturbed by these unfortunate developments were the parents and guardians of the YMBA members, especially those whose sons had been attending the evening tutorial classes. To them it was unbelievable that a Buddhist monk should have behaved in the high-handed and unsympathetic fashion that Aniruddha had done, and that students turning up at the Vihara should have been sent away with rough words. Yet such was the case, and they could only exclaim, as the Nepalese Brahmin student had exclaimed on the day of Aniruddha's arrival, "How can such an angry-looking man be a Buddhist monk?" Or rather, "How can such an angry-speaking and angry-acting man be a Buddhist monk?" This was unfortunate in more ways than one. Not a few of the good people of Kalimpong, both Buddhist and Hindu, had hitherto supposed that only Tibetan lamas were capable of rough and quarrelsome behaviour. Real Buddhist monks, they had believed, monks who wore yellow cotton robes instead of red woolen ones, were different. It now seemed as though the yellow-robed monks were as bad as their red-robed Tibetan brethren. Whether the honours were in fact so evenly divided, I had no means of telling. For the time being, I was having to go on living with the yellow-robed Aniruddha. It did not take me long to realise just how desperate the situation was. However indignant people might feel about the shocking way in which the YMBA had been treated, there was nothing they could really do about it. Even the parents of YMBA members were completely powerless. They had no control over the Vihara, which of course was the property of the Dharmodya Sabha, and no means of influencing what Aniruddha did in his capacity as monk in charge. None of them even knew Aniruddha. The only person who might, I thought, be able to help was Gayan Jyoti. When I visited him at his office in Nepali Building, the smooth-faced, smiling merchant received me with many expressions of sympathy and much shaking of the head in wonderment at Aniruddha's outrageous behaviour. Not that it really surprised him, though. Aniruddha had a reputation for that sort of thing, he told me, and his father, who was also a yellow-robed monk, was even worse. It was lucky for me that they had not both arrived at the same time. Then I would really have had something to complain about. Despite the bantering tone in which he spoke, Gyan Jyoti was not really disposed to make light of what had happened. He was, I could see, genuinely distressed at the trouble I was experiencing, and genuinely dismayed at the way in which Aniruddha was carrying on. At the same time, as I could also see, his loyalties were divided. On the one hand, he was treasurer of the YMBA and did not want to see its activities shut down after such a successful start. On the other hand, he was a Niwa and did not want to find himself in open opposition to a monk of his own community, especially when that monk appeared to be acting with the support of the Dharmodya Sabha, the treasurer of which was his elder brother Maniharsha, and the secretary, their cousin Venerable Mahanama. Another person whose loyalties were divided was Swale. As manager of the YMBA, he could hardly approve of what Aniruddha had done. At the same time, as the guest of the Jyoti family, as he still was, he could not very well come into direct conflict with him. Between the divided loyalties of these two friends, therefore, I was left with plenty of personal sympathy, but no real help, either for the YMBA or for myself. Gan Jyoti counselled patience and hoped that things would somehow turn out all right in the end. Swale breezily commented that I would just have to grin and bear it. The only real sympathy I received, apart from that of my students, who considered themselves below rather than above the battle, came from two Hindu Nuwars, Gopal Pradhan and Madan Kumar Pradhan, were cousins, or perhaps it was brothers-in-law. Both were about 40 years of age, and both lived quite near the Vihara, in bungalows situated at opposite ends of the same compound. There the resemblance between them ended. Gopal Babu, as he was universally known, was stout, cheerful and ebullient, and, when he went out, wore baggy, unpressed Western-style clothes and an old pork-pie hat. Madan Kumar Babu was slim, quiet and thoughtful, and wore a smart three-piece suit when he went out, and Indian, not Nepalese, dress at home. Gopal Babu, though always busy, seemed to have no regular occupation, but functioned as a kind of agent or general factotum to a variety of private individuals and business concerns. Madan Kumar Babu was a successful lawyer who had the largest practice in Kalimpong. He was, moreover, vice chairman of the Kalimpong municipality. The subdivisional officer was chairman ex officio, and well known for his public spirit. In recognition of his services to the community, the previous government had awarded him the title of Rai Sahib. On any given day, Gopal Babu might be anywhere in the bazaar or the development area. Madan Kumar Babu was almost certainly either in the kachari or court, or at home in his office, besieged by clients. Gopal Babu smoked bidis or country cigarettes. Madan Kumar Babu smoked English or American cigarettes, which he drew from a gold cigarette case and inserted in a long holder. Gopal Babu was comparatively poor. Madan Kumar Babu was comparatively rich, as with 10 or 12 children to support, to his cousins or brother-in-laws, 4 or 5, he had every need to be. Which of these two allied but dissimilar Pradhans I had first met, it would be difficult to say, probably Gopal Babu. Whichever of them it was, by the time of my trouble with Aniruddha, I'd come to know both of them fairly well, and had been invited to each of their homes for a semi-ceremonial food offering on more than one occasion. Gopal Babu's eldest son had in fact been attending the evening tutorial classes, and both men knew quite well what the YMBA had been doing. Having realised that no help could be looked for from Gyan Jyoti, it was therefore to Gopal Babu and Madan Kumar Babu that I turned, not for sympathy, but for advice, or at least the opportunity to talk things over. Such an opportunity they certainly gave me. Their two bungalows being so close to the Vihara, only a quarter of a mile up the road, and then 150 yards down the crooked path on the left, I went and saw them several mornings in quick succession. In the course of those visits, I received, besides real sympathy, a little advice and quite a lot of information. So far as the YMBA was concerned, Madan Kumar Babu told me kindly, our position was hopeless. It was with the permission of the Dharmodaya Sabha that we had been using the Vihara for our activities, and that permission having been withdrawn, as it now seemed, those activities had been shut down, and there was nothing we could do about it. However roughly and ungraciously Aniruddha might have behaved in the matter, as the official representative of the Dharmodaya Sabha, he was perfectly within his rights in doing what he had done. The best thing for me to do would be to find the YMBA premises of its own and restart our activities there as soon as possible. All the same, he added, with a thoughtful exhalation of cigarette smoke, he could not quite understand why the Dharmodaya Sabha should have taken such strong exception to what I was trying to do at the Vihara, especially as it had originally given us permission to use the place for our activities. Perhaps Aniruddha had exceeded his authority. Perhaps great wisdom had alarmed everybody with his lying reports. I had told my two sympathisers about the ex-monk's incessant letter-writing. Perhaps there had been a difference of opinion within the Sabra itself. Or perhaps, what was most likely, it was all simply a case of ordinary human jealousy. Oh yes, didn't I know it? In starting the tutorial classes, I had done what the Dharmodaya Sabha itself had promised to do a couple of years back. I had succeeded where they had failed. Jyoti Brothers have given the biggest donation, granted, but the truth of the matter was that the building, now known as the Dharmodaya Vihara, had been purchased with money collected from the general public of Kalimpong, and collected, moreover, not for a Buddhist monastery at all, but for a school. He knew. He was one of the people who had been approached for a donation and who had given something. And who had done the collecting? Why, those two prize beauties, the Venerable Amritananda and the Venerable Mahanama. Arriving in Kalimpong one fine day, the pair of them went around collecting money for a school, as they said, at length purchased the present building. After organising a grand opening ceremony, for which dozens of yellow-robed monks were invited, they stayed on at the Vihara, as the building was now called, for a few months without doing anything. And then, having spent the rest of the money that had been collected on luxurious living, departed as suddenly as they had arrived. Neither of them had been seen in the town since, and of course no school of any kind was ever started. That was why people had been so pleased when the YMBA had started evening tutorial classes, and so surprised and bewildered when Aniruddha had shut our activities down. That was why he himself did not quite understand why the Dharmodaya Sabha should have taken such strong exception to what I was trying to do. They should have been grateful to me. I was doing their work for them. By the time I had talked things over with Gopal Babu and Madan Kumar Babu, I had been back at the Vihara for 2 weeks or more, and life with Aniruddha had become increasingly difficult. He had now abandoned all pretense of wanting rent, and what with the scowls, the constant angry mutterings, and the periodic outbursts of rage with which he favoured me, I was left with no doubt whatever that the one wish of his heart was to have me out. So disturbed was the atmosphere of the Vihara, in fact, and so filled with hate that at times it made me feel quite ill. One day, his patience apparently exhausted, Aniruddha's outbursts of rage became more than usually violent. "He would have me thrown out of the Vihara," he stormed, his small eyes red with fury. "He would have me thrown out by force. He didn't care what anybody said. I would be thrown right out of the front door and down the veranda steps. There were people who would do the job for him. He was sick and tired of waiting for me to go." Genuinely alarmed by his threats, I at once went to see Ganjoti. The situation was becoming serious, I told him. Would he please come to the Vihara and remonstrate with Aniruddha? Ganjoti shrugged his shoulders. It was not for him to interfere between two bhikshus, he said, shifting uneasily in his seat. They would have to settle their differences themselves. I therefore went straight from the Nepali building to the two bungalows at the end of the crooked path. Fortunately, Madame Kumar Babu was in. When I told him what had happened, he looked grave. "The best thing I could do," he said, "was to go to the Thana, or police station, and give an information." I had never heard of this procedure before. All I had to do, he explained, was to tell the officer in charge that Aniruddha had threatened to evict me from the Vihara by force, which, of course, was against the law. An entry to that effect would then be made in the station diary, and if Aniruddha attempted to carry out his threat, and if there should be a breach of the peace, the fact that I had already given an information would be useful in helping to establish that I was the innocent party. Besides, he added reassuringly, Aniruddha was sure to hear that I had been to the Tana, and this in itself would cause him to think twice about resorting to violence. Madan Kumar's Babu's advice was sensible and shrewd enough, but I nonetheless felt a strong reluctance to act upon it. A police station was surely the last place in which a Buddhist monk should be seen, for whatever purpose. It was like being seen in a brothel or a butcher's shop. Moreover, one Buddhist monk should be forced to seek the protection of the secular authority against the violence of another Buddhist monk was a dreadful thing. It was not for this that I had received the higher ordination a few weeks ago. By giving an information against Aniruddha, I would be bringing discredit not upon Aniruddha alone, but upon the whole monastic order. Yet suppose Aniruddha did try to throw me out of the vihara, surely that would bring even greater discredit upon the order. In the end, it seemed that giving an information was the lesser of the two evils. Regaining the main road and walking up it as far as the T-junction, I therefore slowly climbed the flight of steps on the right-hand side that gave access to the police station. At the top of the steps stood an enormously fat man in khaki shirt and shorts, whom I at once recognised. It was Inspector Subba, the officer in charge, who, from this favourite vantage point, was accustomed to look down on the main road and along the high street, in order to assure himself that no crimes were being committed within his jurisdiction. He showed no surprise at seeing me, and after greeting me with pompous cordiality, led the way into the small wooden building, hardly more than a shack, that was the Kalimpong police station. Here he seated himself ponderously behind his desk. A handsome young Sikkimese sub-inspector brought me a chair, and I told my story. When I'd finished, Inspector Subba's broad red face creased into a benevolent smile. I had absolutely nothing to worry about, he boomed. Nobody could throw me out of the Dhammoda Vihara. It was against the law. As a Buddhist monk, I had a perfect right to stay at the Vihara for as long as I pleased. And while he was Inspector Subba and in charge of the Kalimpong police station, that right would be upheld. There was no real need to make an entry in the station diary, but he would do so all the same. That Nyuan monk seemed to be a hot-headed sort of fellow, and if necessary, he would have a quiet word with him himself. The handsome young Sikkimese sub-inspector was even more cordial. He had wanted to meet me for some time, he said, as I left the Tana. Could he come and see me one day? He was a Buddhist and wanted to talk about Buddhism. Though it seems strange that I should have encountered more friendliness at the police station than at the Dhammoda Vihara, I felt glad that I had acted upon Madan Kumar Babu's advice and returned to the Vihara feeling more at ease in my mind than I had done for several days. Whether Inspector Subba did have a quiet word with Venerable Aniruddha, I had no means of knowing, but the fact was that the irascible Nyuan monk's threat to throw me out of the Vihara was not repeated, and, what was even more important, no attempt to carry it out was made. This certainly did not mean that Aniruddha was now reconciled to my continued presence at the Vihara. His determination that I should go was as strong as ever. He had only changed his tactics. If I could not be driven out, I must be squeezed out. One afternoon, shouting that he wasn't going to pay my bills any more, he disconnected my electricity and water supply. Being without electricity was no great hardship. Electric light could always be replaced by candles. Being without water was a much more serious matter. I had no water for washing or drinking, and the toilet could not be flushed. My situation was parlous in the extreme. I did not know what to do next. One or two of the Nyuas who occasionally came to the Vihara saw the results of Aniruddha's action with a certain amount of unease, but they said nothing. After all, it was not for them to question the wisdom of what had been done by one of their own monks. Had there been anywhere else for me to go, I would have gone, but I was in a quandary. According to the Vinaya, or monastic code, it was not proper for a full monk to live in the same house with lay people, as Aniruddha well knew. He was a strict observer of the Vinaya. At the same time, there was no other vihara in Kalimpong in which I might take refuge. Unless I took to the open road or went and lived under a tree, I had no option but to stay where I was, regardless of consequences. At this point, Burma Raja intervened. Hearing that he had called to see me, I at once went to the front of the vihara, where I found the magnificently beturbaned old man standing stiffly on the veranda, ignoring Aniruddha's clumsy attempts at polite conversation. "I have come to take you back with me," he announced, tapping the ash from his big Burmese cheroot with his forefinger. "My guest cottage is at your disposal. The taxi is waiting." I had met Burma Raja once before, when he came to the vihara with Prince Peter to hear Dr. Rerich's lecture, and we had then exchanged a few words. Swale had met him a number of times, and knew him quite well, as did Gopal Babu. In Swale's case, he had got to know Burma Raja mainly on the strength of his fluent Burmese. The old man was naturally delighted to meet someone with whom he could converse in his native language, someone who had, moreover, spent much of his life in Burma, and who enjoyed a good Burmese cheroot. As for Gopal Babu, in former days he had been Burma Raja's manager. Even as a boy, in fact, he had run errands and done odd jobs for him. It was from these two people that I had learnt what little I knew about the personage who had intervened thus dramatically in my affairs, and who now awaited my response to his generous proposal with a smile of such warmth and understanding. From Swale I had learnt that he was the nephew of King Thibaw, the last king of Burma, and that his wife was the second daughter of King Thibaw and the notorious Queen Supayalat, known to history as the Cobra Woman. Had Burma now been a kingdom instead of a republic, Burma Raja, as he was popularly known, would in all probability have been king. As things were, however, he remained Prince K.M. Latakin. From Gopal Babu, I had learnt that for many years, Burma Raja had been a leading figure in the social life of Kalimpong, taking a prominent part in everything that went on, from tennis parties to tiger hunts. In the case of his wife, the princess, however, there had been no question of any social life, and hardly anybody ever saw her. Burma Raja was emphatic that until she could appear in society in a manner befitting her position, she would not appear in society at all. Since 1947, the year of independence, there had been no question of either of them appearing in society. The new Indian government having cut their modest allowance by more than half, the old couple were now living in greatly reduced circumstances, and Burma Raja himself led a quiet, semi-retired life. His life was not so quiet as to prevent his seeing his friends, however, nor so retired that he did not know what was going on in the world. Both Swale and Gopal Babu visited him regularly, as I knew, and it must have been from one or other of them, perhaps from both, that he learned of my predicament. Being as impulsive as he was generous, he came at once to the vihara to place his guest cottage at my disposal. It did not take me long to make up my mind to accept his offer. Apart from bundles of unsold stepping stones, I had very little luggage, and everything was soon stowed away in the back of the taxi, which was waiting below at the roadside. While I was packing, Burma Raja remained standing on the veranda, sternly ignoring Aniruddha's requests that he should come in and sit down. "He can't be a real monk," he exclaimed in disgust when we were seated in the taxi. But I did not want to think about Aniruddha. I was too glad to be leaving him and the Dharmodia Vihara behind me. Turning right at the T-junction, we passed the Thana, the post office, the town hall, the jail, and then, swinging slowly round bend after bend, drove along the Upper Cart Road through the development area until we came, after about 2 miles, to the top of a narrow lane flanked by dense evergreens. Turning right down this lane, we eventually emerged into a small grass-covered compound on the open hillside. At the rear, or hillward, end of this compound, there stood a red-roofed bungalow of modest dimensions. Beyond, on a slightly lower level, there was another compound and another bungalow, also red-roofed. Both bungalows faced northwest and commanded much the same view as the Dharmodya Vihara. Burma Raja lived in the first bungalow, which was appropriately named Panorama. The second bungalow was the guest cottage, and to this he now led me. It consisted of 4 or 5 small rooms, the most attractive of which was the front sitting room, where there hung several oil paintings. In this pleasant retreat, I soon made myself at home, monastically speaking. A glassed-in veranda at the back became the Stepping Stone's editorial office. A bedroom was transformed into a shrine and meditation room, the first separate one of my own I had ever had. In this room I placed all the shrine equipment I then possessed, a large Tibetan-style colour print of the Buddha, and a miniature stupa, or reliquary. At night, the bungalow, or guest cottage, as Burma Raja preferred to call it, was strangely quiet. The only sound to be heard was the intermittent tinkle of the tiny wind bells hanging from the eaves of the little Burmese pavilion outside. Sometimes I could hear the silvery chime through my dreams. "Life is sweet," the wind bells seem to be saying, "but not lasting. It passes away, even as the sound of the wind bells passes away on the breeze." Before the week was out, the unpleasant happenings at the Dharmodya Vihara had started to take on a shadowy and insubstantial character, as if they had never really occurred. Burma Raja was an excellent host, and despite his limited means, did everything in his power to make my stay at the guest cottage happy and comfortable. Nearly every morning he came down to see that I was all right, and that I had everything I wanted, and if he saw I was not busy, he generally stayed on talking for a while. Gradually I started looking forward to these visits, and whenever I saw the sarong-clad figure squeezing through the gap in the hedge and eagerly descending the 2 or 3 steps into my compound, I would put aside whatever I was doing and pretend I was not busy that morning. "What, not busy?" he would exclaim, his face lighting up with a smile, after he had poked his turbaned head inquiringly round the door. "Well, in that case..." And he would come quickly in and sit down. In this way we spent a lot of time together, and since Burma Raja was of a frank, communicative disposition, I soon learned a great deal more about his background and present position than Swail and Gopal Babu had been able to tell me. As was perhaps only natural, he often talked about the deposed King Tibor, and about what it had been like to live in the famous Golden Palace in Mandalay, before the annexation of the Kingdom of Ava in 1885. Oh, the dazzling profusion of riches! Oh, the endless intrigues! Oh, the appalling massacres, when princes and princesses of the blood were trampled to death by elephants in red velvet bags specially imported from Antwerp. But King Tibor was not a bad man, Burma Raja hastened to assure me. I must not believe everything that had been written about him, especially by the British. If I did not mind him saying so, he added quickly. King Tibor was a very good man, a very kind man, and extremely religious. He always fed the monks. Hundreds of them at a time would be invited to the palace for this purpose. Since Burma Raja spoke rather rapidly and tended to jump breathlessly from one topic to another, especially when he spoke about King Tibor, it was difficult to tell what had really happened in those far-off days. It was also difficult to tell how much Burma Raja himself actually remembered and how much he had heard from King Tibor or from Queen Supayalat, though her name was never mentioned, and how much he had learned from Burmese books about the period, of which there was a good collection in the sitting room, many of them illustrated with photographs of members of the royal family and palace officials in the magnificent court deva costume, with sort of flames rising from their shoulders, elbows and knees. "Look, look," he would exclaim excitedly, pointing to one of these illustrations. "That's how we used to dress in those days." So far as I was able to make out, Burma Raja could not have been more than 2 or 3 years old at the time of King Tibor's deposition from the Lion Throne. And when the royal family was exiled to India, he had been taken with them. On the long voyage from Rangoon to Bombay, there occurred an incident about which Burma Raja spoke more than once. King Tibor owned a magnificent ruby the size of a pigeon's egg, which he prized above all his other possessions. This ruby he entrusted for safekeeping to the British officer who was escorting them. When they reached their destination, however, the officer denied all knowledge of the ruby, and despite anything he could say, the king never saw his ruby again. Burma Raja used to shake his head sadly over this incident. He was not so much sorry for the loss of the ruby. He was sorry that a British officer and gentleman could behave so badly. From Bombay, the royal family was taken to Ratnagiri, 200 miles further down the coast, and here they all remained until King Tibor died. Burma Raja and the princess had moved, or had been moved, to Kalimpong some years before the war. There was another princess living in Calcutta, I gathered, and yet another living in Rangoon. She had married an Australian who owned the local racecourse. From the way in which Burma Raja told me this, it was clear that, while he recognised the princess's right to marry whoever she pleased, there was no doubt in his mind that by marrying a foreigner and a commoner, she had automatically forfeited her position as a member of the royal house of Alumpra. He himself was proud of the family to which he belonged, proud of the royal blood that flowed in his veins, proud of being Burmese. It was surprising how intensely Burmese he was. King Tibor had taught him to write the Burmese language in its more difficult literary form, and he invariably wore Burmese dress. The latter consisted of a kind of Norfolk jacket, grey or purple in colour, worn over a deep crimson or green or gold sarong of heavy hand loom silk. His head was swathed, indoors and outdoors alike, with a silk turban of some matching colour, of the type associated with the late Queen Mary, lofty rather than low, and broader at the top than at the bottom. The only part of his costume that was of Western origin were his black leather shoes. One day I asked him where his magnificent sarongs came from, as they were certainly not available in Kalimpong, or perhaps even in Calcutta, and he seemed to have quite a stock of them. His eyes sparkled. "Friends, send them to me. Friends, send them to me," he said laughingly, dismissing the subject with a wave of the hand, as though he had a network of loyalist agents and supporters all over Burma, who were only too happy to send him such trifles. Besides wearing his colourful Burmese dress, which made him look picturesque enough already, Burma Raja also sported a pair of fierce handlebar moustaches of truly regal dimensions, which he cheerfully admitted to dyeing. Indeed, whereas his moustaches were black, the wisps of hair that escaped from beneath his imposing turban were grey in colour, if not actually white. As intensely Burmese as he was, when his native land gained independence in 1948, Burma Raja had been in no hurry to return. Independent Burma might be, but it had proclaimed itself a republic, and he had no idea where he stood under the new dispensation. Or rather, he had a very good idea where he stood. Yes, the rascals who were now in power had indeed invited him to go back. They had made all sorts of promises, but he was too old a bird to be caught with such chaff. He knew why they wanted him back. They wanted him back so that they could have him put quietly out of the way. Clearly, Burma Raja had not forgotten the red velvet bags and the elephants. If he went back, he would go back on his own terms. They had offered him a pension. Let them give him his rights. Never mind if they didn't want to have him back as king. That was their business. He didn't particularly want to be king. But let them give him what was his own. Let them give him his gold mines and ruby mines, or at least the ruby mines. These had been King Thibaw's personal property. They were not the property of the state. Oh yes, he had written to the President of Burma, as the fellow called himself. "Give me back my ruby mines, you thieves, you rascals," he had told them. Oh yes, he had written plainly and straightforwardly enough. There was no point in beating about the bush. Right was right. Who were these upstarts anyway? He had never heard of them before. They still had not replied to his letters. He couldn't think why. He thought he had written plainly enough. Probably they were too ashamed of themselves to write. Or probably not. Such people were completely shameless. They had stopped paying his allowance. Or rather, they had not even started paying it. Originally, the government of India had paid, that is, the old imperial government, 1,000 rupees a month for himself and the princess. When India became independent, the new government stopped paying. They said the government of Burma ought to pay. The government of Burma refused to pay unless he returned to Burma. There was the rub. For a year or more, he had received no allowance from anyone. If good friends like Prince Peter had not rallied round, he and the princess would have been in serious trouble. In the end, something had been sorted out. Other good friends, like Madan Kumar Babu and Gopal Babu, had written to the government of India, and the government of India now gave him 400 rupees a month, which barely covered the necessities of life for himself, the princess, their adopted son, and the maidservant. That was why he no longer took any part in the social life of Kalimpong. He was unwilling to accept hospitality. He was not in a position to return. But he had not forgotten about the ruby mines, he added, his face brightening. Only the other week he had written another letter to the President of Burma, ordering him and his fellow gangsters to hand over his property forthwith. He had given the letter to Gopal Babu to send by registered post. This time there would certainly be a reply. The stopping of his allowance was not the only unpleasant experience Burma Raja had to endure after India became independent. Only a year before I met him, there had been the painful matter of the confiscation of his rifles and shotguns. As a keen amateur sportsman, the old man possessed quite a collection of these weapons. Indeed, from the stories he told me, I sometimes thought he must have kept a small arsenal at Panorama. Either because he had not paid his license fees, or because they wanted to reduce the number of firearms held by members of the public, the authorities had decided that all Burma Raja's weapons should be confiscated, and had directed him to hand them in at the police station. This Burma Raja flatly refused to do. A sub-inspector was therefore sent to Panorama to take possession of the weapons. Burma Raja took a pot shot at him from a window, and he was forced to withdraw without carrying out his mission. The next thing that happened was that a party of armed police arrived on the scene and took up position in the lane. Burma Raja's response to this development was to barricade himself in the bungalow and threatened to open fire if anyone came too near. Oh yes, he would have shot them all right, he assured me cheerfully. They had no right to enter his compound without his permission. First he would have shot the princess. Then he would have shot as many policemen as he could before they shot him. That was the important thing. The princess must not be touched. She was sacrosanct. Any views that the princess herself might have had about being dispatched in this summary fashion, Burma Raja did not, apparently, think it necessary to take into consideration. He seemed to look upon her as a kind of dynastic fetish that had been entrusted to his care and which must at all costs be protected from profanation. Fortunately, the authorities had no wish to drive matters to an extremity. The police remained out of sight behind the evergreens. Burma Raja did not carry out his threat to open fire, and the princess survived to be shot by her protector on some other occasion. Madan Kumar Babu and Gopal Babu had intervened in good time, so it seemed, and thanks to their good offices, Burma Raja had at length been persuaded to hand over his rifles and shotguns peacefully. The truth was, however, that the idea of killing the princess in order to protect her from being touched by profane hand was something of an obsession with the old man, and he often spoke of it. "I'd kill the princess," he would say, his eyes gleaming, after describing some imaginary crisis. "And then I'd kill everybody else. They could kill me if they wanted to. I wouldn't mind." So evident was the enthusiasm with which he expressed himself on the subject that I sometimes thought the idea of falling across the dead body of the princess, mortally wounded, after killing 100 men single-handed, rather appealed to Burma Raja. He seemed to think it would be a glorious death. Despite Burma Raja's obsession with the idea of killing her, the princess had somehow managed to survive, and one morning after we had talked as usual, the stout-hearted old man took me up to Panorama to see her. She was much shorter than he was, and, as I knew already, several years older. Like him, she wore Burmese dress, which in her case consisted of a silk sarong and a short silk jacket. Her hair was drawn tightly back from her face, thus accentuating the sloping forehead, which, together with the heavily lidded eyes, gave her the well-known cobra-headed look, characteristic of all members of the House of Alompra. Her head was not, however, the princess's only striking feature. Besides having a pronounced stoop, on account of which her head was almost lower than her shoulders, she had a way of swaying her body from side to side as she walked, and darting her beady black eyes suspiciously in this direction and that. One almost expected to see a forked tongue flickering out from between her lips. When she spoke, it was in a rapid, confidential whisper, and she kept glancing over her shoulder, as if afraid of being overheard. Though Burma Raja must have told her who I was and why I was staying at the guest cottage, her pleasure in seeing the yellow robe was strangely mingled with doubt, distrust, and apprehension. It was almost as though she suspected Burma Raja of having commissioned me to make sure, once and for all, that the fetish could never be profaned, and that the unknown person in the yellow robe whom he had brought to see her was not a monk at all, but an executioner in disguise. When I had been up to Panorama a few times, however, and she had made the usual ceremonial food offering without being stabbed or strangled afterwards, she lost much of her nervousness and started confiding in me. At least, that is what she seemed to be doing. Whenever Burma Raja's back was turned, she would start giving me what appeared to be urgent messages for various people, not without many nods and gesticulations, to the effect that Raja Sahib, as she always called him, must on no account be told anything about the matter. What the messages actually were was by no means clear, as on the occasions on which she confided in me in this way, the princess's customary whisper sank so low, while the mixture of Hindi and Nepali in which she spoke became so rapid and intense that it was virtually impossible for me to make out what she was saying. Some of the messages seemed to be meant for Madan Kumar Babu and Gopal Babu, however, and seemed to have something to do with money. Whether such was actually the case or not, I nodded understandingly to everything she said, and with this she appeared satisfied. Besides the princess herself, on my visits to Panorama, I also saw the other two members of Burma Raja's little household. These were the old couple's adopted son and his Nepalese maidservant, who was his real mother. The adopted son was a sullen, graceless youth of about 19 who had been given the Burmese name of Aulongi. He was supposed to be going to school, but I knew from my students that such was not in fact the case, and that he spent the whole day loafing about the bazaar and getting into bad company. Even had news of this reached Panorama, it is doubtful if Aulongi would have been given anything more than a mild scolding. Both Burma Raja and the princess doted upon the boy, who as a result had been thoroughly spoiled. I also knew from my students that Aulongi had not been doing well at school, and that he was far from popular with the other boys. They had in fact changed his name from Aulongi to Aluji, which was Hindi for Mr. Potato. On account of the airs he gave himself as Burma Raja's son, despite the fact that he hardly ever had any money, they also called him Ek Paisako Raja, or Prince One Farthing. The most remarkable thing about Aulongi, however, was his unmistakable resemblance to Burma Raja and the princess, especially the latter. The same sloping forehead, the same heavily lidded eyes. What could it mean? The Nepalese maidservant, Aulongi's mother, was a flattering, wheedling, ingratiating woman who danced constant attendance on the Rani Saiba, as she always called her, and who functioned not only as her housekeeper and confidant, but as the entire royal court as well. Burma Raja seemed to take very little notice of her. One of the few occasions on which the court was not present was when the Rani Saiba performed her devotions. This she did always quite alone. According to Burma Raja, the princess was a devout Buddhist who, in addition to her morning and evening devotions, spent much of her time in meditation. One day, at his suggestion, she showed me her shrine room. This was the smallest room in the bungalow and contained little more than a meditation mat and a low wooden table. On the table were five or six Buddha images, none of them more than 4 or 5 inches in height, and all so thickly covered in gold leaf as to present a distinctly fat and lumpy appearance. Besides performing her devotions to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the princess also made offerings to the Devas, or Shining Ones. This did not surprise me. Worship of the Nats, or Devas, was, I knew, an integral part of Burmese popular Buddhism, indeed a part of popular Buddhism in all the Theravada countries of Southeast Asia. It was well understood, though, that the Devas, the gods and spirits, were not able to help one in the attainment of Nirvana. Only the Buddha could do that. But being more powerful and more long-lived than men, they were able to help one in the acquisition of material things. They were mundane by nature, not transcendental. Theirs was the glory that passes away, not the peace that abides forever. Nonetheless, the Devas worshipped by the princess were no ordinary Devas of hill or plain, tree or lotus pond. They were, so Burma Raja solemnly assured me, the guardian Devas of the royal house of Alumpra. They had dwelt with King Thibar among the crimson pillars of the Golden Palace in Mandalay. They had accompanied him to his place of exile at Ratnagiri. Now they lived with the princess and himself at Panorama. He had never seen them with his own eyes, of course, but the princess saw them every day. They were no more than 2 or 3 inches in height, had butterfly-like wings, and when they flew through the air, they emitted a brilliant golden radiance. This was surprising enough, but more was to come. As I had no doubt observed, Burma Raja continued with an appreciative chuckle, The princess was not just a devout Buddhist, not just an advanced meditator. She possessed magical powers of a high order. Whenever they were really short of money, as indeed happened from time to time, all that the princess had to do was to make offerings to the devas, and they gave her money, usually in the form of 100 rupee notes. When she went into the shrine room the next morning, there the money was, underneath the Buddha images. The devas had put it there during the night. This was so extraordinary a circumstance that the next time I saw Gopal Babu, I told him exactly what Burma Raja had said. The former manager was inclined to be amused. He knew all about the princess's magical powers, he assured me with a short laugh. He knew more about them than Burma Raja did. The princess was certainly visited by the devas, but they were 5 or 6 feet in height, and they wore white dhotis and yellow turbans. The truth of the matter was, he explained, taking pity on my ignorance, that as Burma Raja had told me, he and the princess were from time to time very short of money. When this happened, the princess borrowed from the Muraris, who, as I knew, were great moneylenders. Burma Raja himself absolutely refused to borrow money from anybody, and had he known what the princess was doing, he would have been very angry. The princess therefore told him that the devas had brought the money, and since he had implicit confidence in her, he believed what she said. Sometimes, though, he added, with a mischievous expression, the thought occurred to him that perhaps Burma Raja only pretended to believe. Perhaps he simply turned a blind eye to the princess's machinations. But the devas certainly visited Panorama. They usually came late in the evening, when Burma Raja was either reading or dozing. The princess slipped out of the back door and met them in the lane, having arranged everything beforehand through the maidservant. Sometimes her plans miscarried. A message might be delayed or misunderstood, and the devas would either not turn up or turn up late. Sometimes, therefore, the princess would have to stand waiting in the lane for hours on end. To me it seemed both pitiable and ironic that the daughter of a woman who had intrigued her way to absolute power over a whole kingdom should be reduced to intriguing with moneylenders for the sake of a few 100 rupees, and that she should have to stand waiting for the money in the dark at the bottom of a deserted lane. Whether Burma Raja really believed the princess's story about the devas putting money underneath the Buddha images in the shrine room, or whether he only pretended to believe, was difficult to tell. Sometimes I thought that at the very bottom of his mind, he knew what was going on, but refused to admit that he knew, even to himself. There was no doubt, however, that he believed in the occult. Indeed, he was very interested in it. Sometime before the war, he and Moti Chand Pradhan, who was a great friend of his, had established in Kalimpong a lodge of the Theosophical Society. They had rented a room in the high street and organized weekly meetings and discussions. The favorite topic of discussion was the occult, though later this was superseded by the teachings of J. Krishnamurti. Burma Raja himself was particularly interested in occult physiology and occult cosmology, and there were books on these arcane subjects in the sitting room of the guest cottage, most of them bearing the stamp of the now defunct lodge. Occult cosmology included occult geography, and here Burma Raja's interest had come to centre on the Sumeru system. He was fascinated, indeed obsessed, by the image of Kailash, the mountain generally regarded as the earthly embodiment of the axis of that great system. He had not seen Kailash, which was situated in the southwestern corner of Tibet, 100 miles or so from the Indian border, but he had seen photographs of the holy mountain and knew exactly what it looked like. Indeed, he had tried to depict it in numerous paintings. Two of these hung on the wall of the sitting room, and there were others elsewhere in the guest bungalow, as well as up at Panorama. Burma Raja was not a skilled artist, but he had received a few lessons from Kanwal Krishna on one of his visits to the area, and had captured the main features of Kailash quite well. There, at the centre of the painting, either flanked by lesser mountains or surrounded with rainbows, was the white dome-shaped mass, looking as though it was indeed the abode of gods, as ancient legend maintained. Burma Raja was dissatisfied with all these efforts. None of them really succeeded, he told me, in depicting Kailash as he saw it in his mind's eye. But he would try again. One day he would succeed. Not all Burma Raja's paintings were devoted to the subject of Kailash. Some of them reflected his more mundane interests. One of the most striking of these, which also hung on the wall of the sitting room, showed Burma Raja himself wearing his usual Burmese dress, in the act of shooting an enormous Bengal tiger that had reared up on its hind legs and was about to spring on him. What with the vivid green of the surrounding jungle, the dull orange of the enraged beast, and the rich reds and purples of the erect figure of the huntsman, it was a sufficiently colourful piece of work. But the subject? Sometimes it seemed as though Burma Raja's interests were of a rather contradictory nature. One day, therefore, when our talk had ranged more widely than usual, I asked him when it was that he had enjoyed life most of all. The old man did not hesitate. "When I've meditated," he said emphatically, "and when I've killed something." Though Burma Raja no longer meditated very much, any more than he went tiger hunting, he was fond of talking about the subject. He was also fond of talking about the Devas, especially the guardian Devas of the Royal House of Burma. One did not have to be a member of the Alumpra family in order to see them, he explained. Anybody could see them, whether king or commoner. In my own case, it was surprising that I had not seen them already. After all, I meditated regularly, I lived near Panorama, and the Devas were, he knew, well disposed towards me. Something would have to be done about the matter. He would go and speak to the princess. He would ask her to send one of the Devas down to the guest cottage at once. Before I could stop him, he had jumped up from his chair, was out of the door and scrambling up the steps between the two compounds. "Stay where you are," he called out over his shoulder as he disappeared through the gap in the hedge. "I shall be back in half an hour." It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and since it was pleasant to sit there simply enjoying the peace and tranquility of the place, I did exactly as I'd been told. After what I had heard from Gopal Babu, I did not expect to see anything. I did not expect anything to happen at all. 10 minutes passed, 20 minutes, half an hour. Suddenly I heard Burma Raja coming down the steps. "Have you seen anything? Have you seen anything?" he demanded excitedly, before he had even entered the door. "The princess has just sent one of the Devas down." I had not seen anything. But something had happened. 2 minutes before Burma Raja's arrival, the room had suddenly filled with the strong, unmistakable scent of roses. End of chapter 7.